Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 63 of Dominaria Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And this week we are, I guess, just kind of checking in and taking stock. We don't have some really big overarching theme. We're just kind of seeing what's going on in the modern format at the moment.
Yeah, it feels like things are reaching a relatively stable point for now. Dominaria United releases in, what, about a month or so? But until then, I think we have a pretty good idea of the shape of the format, and it's just kind of good to check in and see where, given that stability, everything lies. So we're going to do a bit of overrated, underrated on a bunch of one-off cards. Also, because Modern is sort of a format of individual cards these days, where if you like to play a card, you can put it into a lot of different shells. So it's worth checking in and seeing if a card is good. Maybe it is a reason to start building other things aside from the, you know, maybe one thing that plays it now, or if a card is a little worse, maybe, you know, you might want to trim it from your sideboard of whatever the 15 different decks that play it there.
Yeah, I don't know if my expectations have been scrambled by what felt like a year of just being bombarded constantly with new spoilers and new sets and new cards, but I'm at the point now where I'm fiending for new spoilers. I want new cards to sink my teeth into, because in modern terms, this has been a pretty long off-season now since the release of Streets of New Capenna, and there have been several other releases in the meantime for other audiences. So you have Commander Legends, the Baldur's Gate set, and there's been a lot of other stuff going on, but in terms of an injection of new cards into Modern, this is going to be the first new stuff in quite some time now.
Yeah, and even Streets of New Capenna, like, that was a shockingly impactful set with Ledger Shredder. There's questions about, you know, whether a standard release has the same impact over and over, though I know Mauro, one of his listed things in his state of design was starting to think about how cards interact with everything over time. So maybe this is like, because Modern and Commander are such popular parts of the Magic ecosystem these days, they're going to actually attempt to put cards that are more relevant for those formats in standard releases. So maybe we can sort of expect a little more push in that direction.
Maybe, though, having said that, I think it was at Puppeteer Clique or something to that effect on Twitter who gave a tweet that was just the same paragraph effectively stating that goal to make everything more backwards compatible from each of the last four State of Design articles. So I don't know if this is just a thing that we're vaguely working towards in the medium term or something that we can actually expect to see realized anytime soon.
Yeah, that is very fair. You know, I'm not going to rant about the block structure and everything or whatever on this pod. That's a different podcast kind of story. But yeah, there's some problems in the last few years with that switch.
Yeah, and that might be a good segment to have in its own right at some time in the future in some kind of slow news week. For now, though, let's dive into the results from the weekend, because we have the usual two challenges and then also the showcase playoffs. So the actual, I guess, higher stakes event being held on Magic Online by some metrics. So we'll start with the ordinary Saturday challenge, and this was won by Bill Siv, you know, notable Magic Online grinder, with the Elemental Glimpse deck, which has been increasing in popularity and which he has been a pretty big proponent of both online and offline. I think the most notable feature here is the return of Chancellor of the Forge, of all things, in that that flex slot, I guess, that is usually occupied by formerly Seasoned Pyromancer and now Fabled the Mirrorbreaker.
Yeah, I think that this is something that I've mentioned before and trying to push back against that, which is that the hard elementals list of this deck were really in a spot where they were, when they cast Glimpse, it was kind of a short combo, like similar to like Footfalls making a bunch of things, and then like you didn't really generate too much advantage off of that to really make your next Glimpse super big. So you kind of ended up in a spot where like, oh, you know, I've resolved a Glimpse, I hope that's enough. And Fable was the like least important card in the deck. Just it made some material, and that's about it. So Chancellor, on the other hand, is a card that really makes it so that you are combo killing when you cast the second Glimpse. And that is, I think, fairly important, like a fairly relevant upgrade if you're concerned about actually just killing your opponent. So that is pretty important change to be able to make. I'm actually going to be fiddling a bunch with this deck over the next week, probably. So expect to see some updates in the Discord, which I think now might be a good time to segue into, you know, the overhead material. But if you check us out on Twitter at Dominaria underscore, or sorry, if you, this is, yeah, This is a weird thing. No, reading thing. So yeah, if you check us out on Twitter at @Dominaria_pod, our pinned tweet actually has a link to our Discord, where I'll probably be posting some results and findings over the next week about, you know, what I find playing through even more elementals, because I've really enjoyed that deck. And I think I've like sort of turned into an Izzet main for my like primary deck, but I'd like to explore some of the secondary stuff. So yeah, check us out there and take a look at everything. And also, shout out to our patrons. You are the ones that keep us going and allow us to make pay attention to make improvements to the Discord and everything like that. And special shout out to new patron of the week, Jumbo Jones. Thank you for your additional support. With that.
Fantastic screen name as well. We are thankful for all of your custom, but for Jumbo Jones's in particular. But yes, with that, returning to the subject of the Glimpse deck, it's certainly a very just satisfying deck to play. You know, finding that window to spin the wheel, setting that up in advance, and then actually seeing what you get out of that. We did mention when discussing this deck in our four color episode and comparisons last week that this build, compared to some of the more all-in lists from the past, it makes this trade-off of being more fundamentally solid and consistent, but then having its actual, like, Glimpse of Tomorrow angle being a little weaker in terms of the inputs and also the outputs. And Chancellor is a card that really sets you up well on both ends, but it is a free permanent on the front end, and then also a pretty good thing in most board states to hit on the back end as well. And so, especially in a world which is still dominated by Izzet Murktide, like one of the easiest ways to lose in that matchup and fall behind is just against a turn one Rangaban, and you feel a big difference in the games where you have, you know, Colony Gardens maybe by time against that, or where you're on the play versus on the draw, and getting an actual 1-1 to threaten the trade with that off Chancellor is a really nice stopgap in the way there. So in one sense, it's damaging the consistency of the deck because it is occupying this slot where the first 50-something cards with this approach are mostly locked in, and then you have to think how to make up the numbers. And all of the options kind of have their own strengths and weaknesses. So I think you would want to gravitate towards Seasoned Pyromancer, but when your mana base has Colony Garden and Cavern of Souls, just casting Seasoned Pyromancer sometimes is easier said than done, and you might have to pick two out of those three. And so Fable then becomes the next go-to option, but then it feels like a little bit anemic sometimes. And Chancellor is a good candidate for that slot if you're willing to, you know, accept the risk of just drawing that card outside your opening hand sometimes. It is a way to really juice up both ends of your glimpse. It is, like, previously one of the draws to Chancellor before you had the elementals angle was you could discard it to your Seasoned Pyromancer or your Favor of the Mirror Breaker. And so when those cards are competing for the same slots and you don't have those anymore, the Chancellor will get stuck in your hand more often. You can still pitch it to Fury and so on, but that now is an increased risk that you have to accept that you're bearing.
Yeah, I mean, there is also the opportunity to make 7 mana because you control an Omnath or a Risen Reef. So I'm interested to see how often that becomes a reality versus how often it just kind of hangs out in your hand, and whether the right answer might actually be like a mix of Chancellors and Pyromancers or Fables, just kind of like something in the middle.
Yeah, and that can still be one of the first cards that you sideboard out in games that you expect to go longer and where you want some more of these interactive pieces. But in these like combo control races, so thinking again about like the creativity matchup, for example, or against Amulet Titan, or against some of these decks where speed is of the essence, this was one issue I found with the Glimpse Elementals deck, where you kind of felt obliged to fire off your Cascader as soon as possible before they were doing their thing and going over the top, but without any real expectation that you were going to hit what you needed enough of the time. And so with Chancellor in the mix, again, you can glimpse four more and you have more good things to hit to just randomly Yahtzee the opponent out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think that, you know, to segue into the next couple decks, that kind of gameplay was really important here, because in second place, we have the three and a half color creativity deck. And in third place, we have Tron. And both of those are matchups where actually combo killing your opponent way more important than just kind of making like an Omnath and a Fury.
Absolutely. And this creativity deck is going to go one better on Sunday and win that entire challenge. And I think this deck really is the big story of the past few weeks, going from something which wins a tournament here and takes you a little bit by surprise to being just one of the established staple, like tier 1.5 decks of the format.
Yeah, so I had done my monthly breakdown on TCG Player, and the thing I had noticed was that at the tail end of, like, the last month's worth of results, this deck had kind of popped off when Nassif got second in that challenge with it, and then a couple of weeks of good results, and then it kind of tapered down, and it wasn't really clear whether it was going to go, like, oh, you know, this is not going to be good permanently, and it's going to kind of be in that affinity tier of, like, when it top eights, you aren't surprised, but also you aren't scanning top eights looking for it. Or if it would, you know, find its way back. And it feels like it's really the latter. Some of that may just also be the uptick in, like, Hammer, which is that cycling around. The Amulet matchup, I don't think is that bad. And you can, like, really, you know, this, you are a Force of Vigor deck that has, like, a lot of things going for you along that angle. There's just, like, a lot of things that make this deck able to be well-positioned at times, while also just, like, being a fundamentally good deck. I don't have a good reason why it would have kind of disappeared for a few weeks, but overall, if it keeps putting up these results, I think that it may just be like, you know, it's which of the 2 weeks of the previous month were a fluke, and it's looking right now like it was the two where this deck didn't show up.
Yeah, it seems like this deck does have the staying power it needs. One deck where I'm not sure if I can say that yet is this glorious hot mess that we see in fourth place from Tiyuhan, and this is a Nonsense of the Week shoo-in. If it just showed up in the 5-0 league decklist dump, instead this is showing up in the top four of a modern challenge, so even better. Always nice to see that the wacky deck's putting up results on a bigger stage. And this is Yorion Urza Saga Humans, and not just like we've seen lists in the past where there was a Lurrus Saga Humans deck that was mostly mono white, as I recall, and you could see how a lot of the pieces fit together here. This is Yorion Saga, five color human. So we still have the, like, secluded courtyard, unclaimed territory mana base, and we still have humans ranging across the color pie from Noble Hierarch to Meddling Mage to Torak. Like, we have a one-off Torak in this deck. And then, you know, we're going all across the board here.
Yeah, the really interesting part to me is if you look at the mana base, there is still an Ancient Ziggurat in there.
Oh, yeah.
Cannot activate Saga. But there's also a Reflecting Pool, which is, that does add mana with Urza Saga, but there's a lot of weirdness going on there. I also like that there's just a Turok under the assumption that, like, maybe all the other lands come together. There, like, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, there's a shocking number of lands that do not produce black mana for these. There's multiple Turoks in the 75. I'm sorry. There's a lot of lands that do not produce the black mana for that.
Yeah, Mana Confluence with Urza Saga is not a match made in heaven either, and I think the cherry on top of all of that is in the sideboard we have Magus of the Moon, because sometimes that is the hammer that you want in the matchup. It is a human to force through with all of your 12 different lands that care about creature types. And even though that will be killing your own Urza Saga, you know, a really big anti-synergy there. Like, in the matchups where Magus is good, like, if you have that against Amulet Titan, you're KOing their Urza Saga and so much more. So you will gladly take that trade off.
Well, can we talk about the Kataki Urza Saga interaction too? Because that's also in this list.
It sure is. There's a lot to unpack here, as they say. And in the 60 card versions, the usual five color humans decks, you now have enough good rainbow lands that you can almost stitch all of that together without even trying. You have your 8 unclaimed territories, effectively, thanks to Secluded Courtyard. You have 4 Cavern of Souls. And so beyond that, you don't need that many lands in total. So you can sprinkle in a basic or two here, like a Canopy land and maybe some Seachrome Coast or Rageverse Thickets or something, and get to the land count you need. When you're a Yorion deck, you have 8 to 10 more slots to fill with lands. And so, that's how you get the Ancient Ziggurat Urza Saga pairing, or just Urza Saga in general. Maybe that's how that one sinks its way into the deck here.
Yeah, very strange. Also, just, like, not a lot of artifacts for these sagas, but just a way to produce bodies that you are going to attack your opponent with, which is approximately all the rest of your deck does. I guess Esper Sentinel is a notable artifact, Aether Vial, that's, like, part of the way there. But yeah, this deck is attempting to do a lot of things. I remain slightly skeptical with the fact that Fury won this tournament, and, like, the other decks that did well are also, like, kind of a problem, but I don't know. The human strategy continues to put up approximately a top 8 a month, and every single time I read the deck list and think, I'm never going to do this, but I can imagine a lot of ways it beats people.
I'm not sure I've ever seen a deck that is worse at casting its own spells with Urza Saga than this one, where, like, I guess it cast her on Etherbile, so that's like a decent curve to shoot for. But this one is not casting your Noble Hierarch or your Champion of the Parish or your Esper Sentinel on turn one. It certainly is not casting your Meddling Mage on turn two. And if you are working towards that one off Torak, this is yet another land that's not casting that one either. So this is a colorless land in this deck, and you feel that very acutely. So another reason to perhaps be skeptical of the strategy on the whole. But if you expect a lot of Cascade decks, you flagged up Glimpse obliquely, like as a Fury deck winning the challenge. It is a Fury deck, but it's also a deck where like the Cascade angle runs headfirst into main deck Thalia plus main deck Medley Mage plus, you know, all of the other cards in the Human's Toolbox, which typically line up very well against those. So if you can dodge, I guess, exactly Fury, then maybe the rest of your deck can beat the rest of their deck.
Yeah, I also like admitting that, like, the entire Humans plan is already bad enough against Turn 1 Ragavan that consistency in answers is not a huge deal. Like, I mean, adding Esper Sentinel helps a little, but, like, I don't know. It's not a... If you get Murktided with this deck, I don't love that matchup, but adding the cards is not really going to hurt you.
We have some Baraton Fortenders and some Sanctifier on Vex in the sideboard here, but if you have to play one of your tribal lands on Kithkin, I guess, to cast Fortender, then that's going to shut off a lot of other spells. I guess you could name Wizard. It is also a Wizard, as is Meddling Mage and Reflector Mage. So actually, maybe that's how you square that circle.
Exactly. Yeah, Wizard, Deputy of Detention, also a Wizard. There we go.
Yeah, so this deck is just a treat to look at. I don't know if, you know, if you rent this deck and you take it into a league, I can imagine that being like an 0-1 drop angle. But for now, just processing this from a distance, I can get excited about it.
Yeah. On the subject of Izzet, three of the rest of the top eight are various Izzet lists. The only really interesting part across them is that the dress down appears to have become stock again. But there's just a lot of disagreement on, you know, everyone plays like a very slightly different Izzet list. It looks like the one in eighth is like one card off of what I was playing this last weekend, with the dress down being a Brazen Borrower in the list I played, and a little slightly different sideboard. But, you know, it is it. There's like 56 cards that never change and like 11 sideboard cards that don't really change or something like that. And everyone, you know, picks at random from the remaining Izzet box, and that's their list for the weekend.
Yeah, at this point, it is surprising to see an online tournament like a challenge that isn't, you know, 25% is it in the top 32. So that deck has stood the test of time really better than any other. And, you know, the various four color menaces that people talk about really do ebb and flow in a way that is it and that is it simply hasn't. And so when we talk about like the best deck in Modern, I think is it has to be maybe not an automatic contender there, but at least, you know, worth considering.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I played it last weekend was because I wasn't winning with any of the decks I wanted to play, so it was just kind of like, I should do the exact opposite thing and just play Izzet, and it was good, and I lost to another Izzet deck playing for top 8, and yeah, I don't really have any complaints. Aside from the mirror, kind of like, I don't know, the mirror kind of sucks, but that's, you know, it's hard to complain when that's your biggest issue.
What were the decks you wanted to play?
Let's see... I wanted to play Yawgmoth, and I couldn't buy a win with it. I wanted to try Amulet, and I, like, more than couldn't buy a win with it. Trying to remember what else. Living End wasn't going so great for me. Hammer, like, it reached the point where I was going to play Izzet or Hammer, and I came to the conclusion that both times I was just going to have to think very hard, and I would rather think hard when, like, you have the buyout of just, like, hit them with Ragavan than, like, think hard and do Hammer math.
Mm-hmm. And so Izzet became maybe not something you were actively enthusiastic about, but just like the least bad option that was on the table at that point?
I mean, I was actively happy to play Izzet. It was good. It was just kind of like, can I do better than the default? And the answer was no, so I played the default.
Always sad to see people have to admit defeat like that. But in any case, moving ahead to the Sunday challenge, as we mentioned, won by the four color creativity deck, just an amazing week or two for that deck across the board. And you've put here, shout out to FireEyes, which is a sentiment I can get behind in basically any context, but especially in this one.
Yeah. Someone had actually, you know, a listener had messaged me and said, hey, you know, I'm, you know, bouncing around some tech for this deck. And one of the things they said was they really like Fire Ice. It was really good for them. You know, and I was like, that sounds amazing. And then they won an RCQ this last weekend with it. And then this list won the challenge with Fire Ice. I think that that card should potentially just like creep towards being stock in this deck because of it just kind of does everything you want, right? It's another piece of cardboard. It's interaction. This deck gets to play with Fire Ice in a lot of the same ways that Footfalls Rhinos does, where like your opponent is trying to leave up a counterspell or something, and then they are no longer leaving up that counterspell or something. So I think that Fire Ice is just really well suited to this exact deck and an upgrade worth exploring.
Yeah, both the Fire Harv and the Ice Harv do some great work here. And with Ice in particular, whether you're taking their shields down so that you can find a window to force through, you know, creativity on your 1/1 dwarf token if that's a thing you have to target, or just setting up a window to punch through counterspell or something, or you're just in, I won't say the pseudo mirror because that sounds too narrow, but basically any matchup where speed is of the essence and you can just, you know, turn two ice on their land often is going to be the thing that flips that race in your favor. I think you get to use every part of that card in a really nice way there. So great to see that deck doing well with some interesting pickups there. We see a copy of Yawgmoth once again near the top. This person, I guess, could buy a win with it still, and more to come on that front before too long. And then the rest of this top eight is some of these just assorted fringe linear decks. We've got a copy of Dimir Mill. We've got the Grinding Breach deck. We just got some of the flora and fauna of Modern that adds to its charm.
Yeah, I just want to note that Dimir Mill has put up a little bit more results recently than it had for a while. That may again be a backlash to Hammer, you know, really finding its way to the top of the metagame. And you still, you know, even if they have a Cauldron in their deck, Tasha's Hideous Laughter might leave that in their bottom 10 cards, or it might be in their top 10 cards. So that's pretty good for you. So that deck might be something worth looking at a little more than it had been for a couple months. And then also, the other thing is that the Is It list in this top eight in eighth place is actually Jeskai Splashing Teferi. We'll touch on that a little in the next event, but that has popped up a little more this weekend.
Yeah, this is a True Hero, another grinder that you see around all the time. And their motif seems to be just taking an established deck and adding an entirely new color to it and leveraging that to success. So that result really is no surprise. We do also see, I guess, just Blue by Artifacts, I think, is the best name for it, because these shells, I think they have more tools available to them than basically any other archetype in terms of deck building and card choices. And I think those choices kind of play off each other in a way that is more dependent than in a lot of other decks. So when I see these lists and it's like, and this was a discussion that was raging in our Discord as well, people are asking stuff like, is this actually a good shell for Ingenious Smith? Or, you know, how hard do you want to lean into the Thopter Sword stuff in this deck, or, you know, all of these questions. And my answer to each of them is, I don't know. And I feel like once you go down the road of adding more copies of some particular card, well, then you have to find room for that somewhere, and you're either cutting some of the cheap artifacts that then set up the artifact payoffs, or you're cutting the artifact payoffs and then turning those into new ones. And it feels like actually getting some kind of holistic overview of a deck like this is much more difficult than you think.
Yeah, that was my experience playing with the Urza decks a few months ago, back when they were like still dedicated Urza decks, and I'm not shocked that it continues now. I just want to shout out the fact that this archetype in general, like all these vague artifact decks, are one of Izzet's actually bad matchups, at least the way it's configured. I mean, now, but like also in general, like the Hammer matchup is already problematic, and a lot of the same things transfer here, but also like, there's less ability for like a random removal spell to punch through, and more ability for stuff you see like the 11th place deck just has two hearses in the main deck. That's a big problem. Just constant access to Aether Spellbomb, so Murktide's not an issue. There's just like a lot of generalized things that these artifact decks do that make things bad for the Izzet deck.
Mm-hmm. Let's get on to the showcase qualifier here. So this is the event that the small exclusive event that the monthly showcase challenges feed into. So the top eights from those make it to here, and then the winner here goes to this newest iteration of the Magic Online Championship Series, which is going to be held, I think, early next year. And so the winner here is Claudio on Yawgmoth. And you may remember Claudio as just like the one guy who was playing Pioneer for most of like 2020, 2021, before that format worked its way back into the competitive rotation and was just like winning every event in sight with some new list of a five color Niv and so on. But has definitely showed his chops in Modern as well. And I remember in the first week with MH2 playing against him in the Modern Challenge when he was on Yawgmoth. So no stranger to this archetype and has been coming back to it in the months since and putting up some decent results with it and able to qualify for the mocks with it this past weekend.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. I think the interesting thing for me from these results was actually kind of looking at what the various like modern dedicated players are doing in response to the idea that they're playing against all the other modern dedicated players. And like, we see things like two Belcher decks making the top eight, and that feels like it has to be a dedicated metagame call of like, I believe everyone is going to play Traverse 4C. And even though that wasn't true, the deck still did good enough. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and the rest of that top eight, so there are two copies of Yawgmoth, which I have to imagine is still a good matchup for Belcher. And then Hammer, which I think was difficult for Belcher in the past, just because on raw speed, I think Hammer had you outgunned, and then generally their sideboard cards were better, and they were better at supporting those sideboard cards. I don't know how true that is in a world where, you know, we've seen this move back to like Azorius Hammer, but also Mono White Hammer, and the disruptive tools that each of those decks have access to are pretty different. I imagine the Hammer decks are still faster on average. Like, that's one thing that hasn't really changed with the Lurrus Band, for example, but have not had a cause to revisit that since, you know, the latter half of last year. So I would be certainly willing to update my assumptions on that.
Yeah, I'd have to take a look at the exact list. When I played Belcher, the lists were very skewed towards Hammer, and you can definitely build a Belcher deck that is good against Hammer. I think, I don't know if it's easier, but like when the Belcher deck loads up on Force of Vigors and Furies, it gets pretty easy for it not to die. But on the other hand, like I think some of the recent Hammer updates, like Stoneforge Mystic into Cauldra is very good against all the hate, and like these lists that are playing Meddling Mage and Mana Leak and Spell Pierce are also big problems. So it's probably, it used to be a lot of agency on the Belcher player side, but I can see both players having a lot of say in what's going on in the matchup before anyone even sits down. So yeah, it's probably the kind of thing that week to week could vary. I think that the Mono White Hammer lists are probably actually behind against Belcher now if the Belcher player cares, though.
The thing I was most curious about when I heard that Claudio won this event with Yawgmoth was how was he and the people he's working with approaching the four-color matchup? Because this is something that we tossed around in the episode that we did a while back that was dedicated to Yawgmoth, and then we've come back to this theme a few times since then of, by and large, Yawgmoth is, you know, pretty solid deck against most things, but the one thing that you need to find a way to fix is that four-color matchup. And so it doesn't seem like there's some obvious Call of Calling or Eldritch Evolution bullet that you can fetch that flips that around. So do you just try and fight fair with them? Are there other sideboard cards which you have to draw? But if you do, then those are enough to have a big impact. And looking at this list, we have a main deck Thorsies, which kind of stands out. I don't think that's specifically just for four-color. It's not like a narrow tool there, although it certainly will be good in that matchup. The thing that stands out most, though, is the two Tauraks in the sideboard. And we mentioned this idea in passing, but I think this is the first list I've seen that actually does try that.
I think that that's actually from Zerk's list from the last couple of weeks. He's really the breakout there. But yeah, the Thoughtseize main and the Tauraks are like pretty big helps there. And I actually wrote an article, you know, about Yawgmoth this week, and those are both in the list. The thing that I noticed that I really like from Claudio's list is moving from Blood Artist to Zulaport Cutthroat. I have had the experience of losing to Living End playing Yawgmoth because I drew Leyline of Sanctity two games in a row. And the big, well, like one of the big issues is that, like, yeah, you can't Endurance them, and it's also why I don't want Thoughtseize in the matchup, but like, you can't kill them. Like, Geralt's Messenger targets, Blood Artist targets, Zulaport Cutthroat does not target.
That feels like it's targeting one situation in one matchup when Blood Artist is just like across the board. It feels like you would get into more situations where you're against Hammer, for example, and having Blood Artist over Cutthroat lets you mow down the board in a spot where maybe your life was under pressure before, and if you just have cutthroat, then you're not able to do that. So it would surprise me if that trade-off is worth it, but like I, of all the Yawgmoth players out there, I'm willing to defer to Claudio over anyone, so.
Yeah, that's like, you know, if you were wondering what that exactly was for, it is literally that. Like, you're not trying to get into combat with Zulaport Cutthroat or anything. It is literally just like, Leyline of Sanctity is showing up in Living End, in Belcher, and like, it's specifically showing up in matchups where you are trying to produce the fastest kill possible, and it's really dicey if you do not have access to the untargetable kill, or untargeting kill.
Other notable features of this list are two Run Afoul in the sideboard, and so I know there was some talk of Ledger Shredder being a card that made the Murktide matchup a lot harder, and now you have this removal spell, which is, I guess, conditional in one sense, and there might be times where they have, like, two Ledger Shredders and they get to sacrifice a small one, or they have a Ledger Shredder and a Murktide Regent and you can't hit the big thing that you really need to. But by and large, like, this kills Ledger Shredder and Murktide Regent, I guess all Murktide Regent, for one mana. And that's something that very other removal spells, especially in this color combination, can save themselves.
Yeah, the also notable are, like, on top of Run Afoul, there's Unlicensed Hearse. So, like, this list is going very hard at trying to hamper Izzet from even getting off the ground. But I guess Hearse also kind of doubles up in the mirror in probably some pretty absurd ways. So, yeah, I think that, like, there's a lot of very dedicated hate cards in the sideboard that are aimed at, like, the exact top decks and not trying to hit a broad field here.
Yeah, I think between the additional endurances, bringing them up to four total copies, the Unlicensed Hearses, and then whatever mix you want of stuff like Run Afoul, Thoughtseize, Veil of Summer, you can really pivot in the Murktide matchup to being this kind of fair rock deck almost with this Yawgmoth combo finish. And with like Yawgmoth naturally, I think, is well set up against Living End, but once you have four endurance in the 75 and two Unlicensed Hearse and the one Chalice of the Void that we see in the sideboard to go with, you know, Thoughtseize, Veil of Summer, and so on, you are really putting the hurt to that matchup. And so I saw someone had made a spreadsheet of what all the players had qualified for this modern playoff with. And I recall there being a lot of Living End in those initial predictions. And so this makes a lot of sense given all of that.
Yeah, I mean, that was the joke, was that all the qualifiers had been won by Living End. It was like, was it two or three or all three?
It may have been all three. I know it was at least two. But looking at the list of matchups that Claudio posted, he actually lost round one to Amulet, and so was, you know, back against the wall immediately, and then beat Hammer, which is something which you're kind of expecting once you pick up Yawgmoth, and then beat four color elementals, beat four color control, beat blue white control, then beat the mirror in the top eight, and then had two more Hammer opponents en route to the title there. So winning the Hammer matchup three times, and then finding a way, I guess, with the cyber plan to beat the two four color decks, and then everything else kind of took care of itself.
Yeah, notably one of those was like elementals. That's like one of the absolute worst matchups, and getting a 2-0 win there has to be a relief, like, no matter what.
Yeah, the elementals aspect of that is tricky, because most of the four color decks are moving away from Fury, and it's only the decks which feel priced into playing it, like Glimpse actually is, as an example you mentioned, but also the elementals decks, where once you're trying to do this Risen Reef Ephemerate thing, some copies of Fury just work their way into that equation. And even if they're not great against the format at large, although looking at this distribution of decks, they look pretty good, they are very good in the Yawgmoth matchup. And so that's the thing you're really hoping to fade. But, you know, Claudio was able to do that and took this whole thing down. So props to him. Can't wait to watch him in action in that match.
Yeah, let's jump on to our one paper result this weekend from Face-to-Face Open, which I have this wonderful copy-paste stolen from Canister's Discord that just basically says the top eight in order of Hammer, Grixis Death Shadow, two burn decks, the lovingly known in Canada Rakdos Scam, five-color Creativity, four-color Elementals, and Living End. So another, you know, great result for Creativity here. You know, the Rakdos Evoke, Rakdos Scam archetype continues showing up in the vague vicinity of Pascal Menard. I think he had kind of had like a showcase finish with that deck early on in the Face-to-Face series, and everyone has kind of latched onto it a little harder there. And then a couple burn, which sort of signifies to me that there's a lot of four color to slice through, but I'll let you chime in on that.
Yeah, worth noting as well that the Run Afouls in Claudio's sideboard also a pretty decent response to Archon of Cruelty. I don't know if that was part of their intended purpose or how that sideboard mapping looks overall, but I imagine that's part of that puzzle as well.
Yeah, that is a nice addition there. There's like also like a few other random things you can pick up with those, but yeah, that matchup and being able to kill an Archon there is pretty important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not too much other commentary on the face-to-face open results. When you said there was a real-life result to get to, I thought we were going to touch on your RCQ foray for a second there, but I guess we can still do that before we end the segment.
Yeah, I mean, real quick, that event was taken down by Josh Warsaw, who I believe we last saw defeating Zach Allen in the finals of an NRG event, playing Traverse 4-color. I don't recall the exact top 8, but I know it was basically piles of, is it 4C, Yawgmoth, and Hammer was basically all I saw. I played is it. I lost round 1 to Abe Stein, who was playing Hammer. Just like one of those games where like you keep a hand and then they play a turn 1 Esper Sentinel and you're like, this is bad. And then they play a turn 2 Esper Sentinel and then it got worse. So that was bad. And I just kind of like had a very, I don't think I lost a game until the mirror I played in the last round. Just like beat a Hammer opponent, beat a mirror, beat Yawgmoth, beat Burn. Just like, you know, a lot of those matches where everything just kind of lines up for you is it. Even if you don't have turn 1 Ragavan, it's just like your opponent casts Eidolon and you play Spellsnare and the game ends. Spellsnare was great, by the way. I would, oh my gosh. If there's anything you want to take away from me playing is it and like chiming in on results, Spellsnare is phenomenal. The game I actually won in my losing out match was due to I mulled, got stuck on lands, finally cast a Murktide with 1 mana up, and my opponent played a counterspell instead of their subtlety because they were afraid of dispute, and they lost the game on the spot.
Nice.
Which was kind of awesome. Big fan of Spellsnare. Definitely promote that. And, yeah, not like a lot of unexpected things playing Izzet. It is like you lose to exactly the things you think you should lose to. You win the games you think you should win. Maybe the only other takeaway was that it was easier than I thought because I think when I had last played Izzet online, I just played a million mirrors and 4-color matches, which are just like, oh my god, the 4-color match is just like all thinking all the time, trying to like min-max every single threat you play at all time. It's so hard. And you're playing out of your mind to like get to 50% there. But like you play against Yawgmoth and it's like, oh, so I need to counter their thing and kill their thing and then kill them. Oh wow, this is all so easy. Like, even the Hammer matchup is, like, relatively easy and way harder for your opponent than it is for you. So I think that my estimation of the gap between Izzet and Hammer as the most difficult deck in the format, Hammer is, like, gone from close to, like, a clear winner. But overall, Izzet's great. Play more Izzet. Yeah.
And that matchup of Murktide versus Hammer is one that was really format-defining in the early days of MH2 Modern, and the consensus at the time was Hammer is a pretty big favorite, and Murktide really has to put the work in to flip that around. Has that changed by this point? It sounds like you're pretty comfortable being on the Izzet side there.
No, I don't think the matchup is especially favorable, but it's close enough, and like, again, your opponent is playing on hard mode in basically every game where they don't have turn 1 Esper Sentinel that goes unanswered, and you're kind of just like, I don't know. It's not easy. Like, you have to think about what your opponent's going to do, but, like, it is always on your opponent to be the one trying to take action most games, or, like, if they're Urza Sogging, you have, like, such a window to maneuver. It is less concerning. It's not, like, actively bad. It's just kind of, like, the amount that it's bad is baked in, but, like, it's not horrific.
Mm-hmm. So, with that, let's get into some analysis of individual cards, and I guess overrated versus underrated is like a good framing for this. So we'll just go down the line here and give some thoughts on a few cards which you can expect to see, but it's unclear exactly how well they're going to perform on any given day.
Yeah, and this is, you know, reassessment for the current modern metagame that has shifted. And I think that like the perfect place to start this with my Izzet discussion is the three secondary Izzet threats of Ledger Shredder, DRC, and Murktide Regent, and like whether each of those is overrated or underrated in the format.
Yeah, let's start with Ledger Shredder then, because this was a card that we devoted an entire episode to when Streets of New Capenna came out, and we focused on all of the various fringe decks that it seemed like were perfect homes for Ledger Shredder. I think with a few months to digest that, none of those decks have been dragged back into relevance by Ledger Shredder. So stuff like, you know, Phoenix or Esper Reanimator or these decks which you can imagine getting this new lease on life as a result, that hasn't really materialized. And so we've seen it pop up in decks which were already on the map and already good and were just maybe looking for some kind of secondary or tertiary threat anyway. The one exception maybe is Grixis Shadow, which I think you can draw this hard line between the list pre-Ledger Shredder and the list post-Ledger Shredder. I think that has been enough to reorient that deck, but I don't know if it's really fixed any of the fundamental issues that it had before. And often it feels like from the other side that I'm almost breathing a sigh of relief when my opponent's playing a turn two Ledger Shredder, because even though it's like a two drop that does a whole lot of things, compared to everything else going on in those decks and in the modern format, it almost feels like a little clunky and a little slow.
Yeah, it almost reminds me, I think it's a little overrated, not like a lot, but just a little bit. It reminds me a lot of like how Scavenging Ooze was when it was first really good, but like it was never like the really threatening thing, but people would be playing two to three and it was always like, oh yeah, that's a good card, but like it's really, really good like 20% of the time and just like good enough a lot of the rest of the time. That's a, maybe Ledger Shredder is a little better than that, but not like a ton.
Yeah, it's still a phenomenal card, and I think an interesting card. I enjoy its play patterns for the most part and what it's doing to the format, but I do think that initial hype where people were just putting this in every deck under the sun, I think that has cooled off a little bit, and for good reason.
Yeah, so let's talk about Dragon Rage Channeler, because I don't know, maybe we have to lump Dragon Rage Channeler and Murktide Regent together, because I think that the overall picture is that they're a little underrated now. The problem is that playing them both at the same time is, like, massively overrated. Then you kind of are in this bind where, like, you have to play just enough so that if your opponent plays a Hearse, you don't immediately die.
Yeah, it would not shock me if the right number over time, like, the equilibrium is exactly two Dragon's Rage Channelers or something like that. And you end up not treating it as a sacred cow, but still wanting access to it anyway. And this goes back to the Shredder discussion insofar as those early lists with MH2 when people were just wholesale cutting Murktide Regent for Ledger Shredder, that put up some early results, but I think with time it's clear that that wasn't because Murktide was subtly the thing that was holding the deck back, and the deck was certainly putting up great results consistently even then. It's that the core of the deck is so fundamentally sound and it's playing good, honest magic, and the question is, what do you want to be working towards? And I think the answer to that is still Murktide Regent, and if you have to cut another threat to do that instead, maybe that's Channeler, maybe it's, you know, you play some Shredders, but not the full four, what have you. But I think moving away from Murktide Regent altogether is a big mistake, and it's one that you really feel the impact of when you play the deck without that card. Like, you feel like you have to work so much harder for so many of your wins.
Yeah, Murktide might be the one that is legit underrated. I played three Shredder, two Channeler, three Murktide, and it felt really good. I can see a world where you just start four Murktides and consider sideboarding one out as a liability at times. That may be like the end state of like, that card's just so good. I think the thing that is understated is how important, like, if you think Murktide is the best deck, Murktide Regent is the most important card. Like, if you were to chart like all the mirror matches, like what is the most important card in the game, Murktide Regent is the card that is like by far the most important in the most games. And if you expect to play mirrors, if you ever play with less than three of this card, you're just going to be so far behind. And also, like, playing with multiples matters a ton. Like, one of the game, game one of the match that I lost was literally just, like, they played a 7-7 Murktide. I played an 8-8 Murktide. They played another Murktide, and the game was over.
Yeah, I think maybe the real underrated card here is the fourth Murktide region, because I think it's more likely that you want to start that card and then you can shave that fourth copy in matchups where either the card doesn't line up especially well or where you expect a ton of hate on the graveyard. But starting the 4-4, I think, still makes a lot of sense to me. Any final thoughts on that trio, whether individually or together?
Not really. It's great. It's hard to over or underrate Izzet at this point because it's just the best deck. And it's really good. So the trio together is exactly as good as everyone thinks it is, unless you don't believe in Izzet, in which case you're just denying reality.
Yeah, at this point, when it is, without exception, the most popular deck and the most successful deck at every tournament, like, it's you versus all that evidence, and it's pretty easy to pick a side at that point.
Yeah. So the next clump of cards I had listed were, I guess, sort of not together, but individually, the five incarnations. And I think this really got started because I played with Subtlety this weekend. And I think Subtlety right now is, like, astronomically overrated in Modern. I have had the experience where I don't really know what matchups I am concerned about. Like, I'm going to pitch a card to Subtlety and feel okay with that as a result. Especially, like, out of Is It? And then, like, casting Subtlety for the full amount is fine, but, like, I don't want to play a card that's just, like, a mediocre high-end threat and a mediocre low-end answer. Like, I just want a card that's good. And Subtlety was never that for me. Except if you're playing against Primeval Titan.
Yeah, so I've been on the wrong end of that exchange too many times. I think you have to kind of pick your spots with this card. So I've had a lot of people ask me about Rhinos recently and the role of, like, the various incarnations in Rhinos, so Endurance and Subtlety. And we've identified Subtlety as a pretty big piece of the puzzle against the various four-color decks and something that, you know, I don't know what the baseline matchup is like for Rhinos against four-color, but Subtlety really is the best thing you can lean on there, I think. Maybe the dynamics are different in Is It, where, like, you're better able to leverage all of your cards because they're so cheap, and you can line up the one-to-one exchanges the way you want to, and you're not as reliant on this temporary exchange is also two for one in yourself at the same time. But I think the card still has a role. Like, if you think there's going to be a lot of Yawgmoth, you know, Subtlety is a great card there. In the matchups with Living End, where you expect a lot of the other pitch elementals, then I think Subtlety is, like, one of the better retrumps to those a lot of the time. I think, unlike all of the others, it's not a card where, okay, I am playing a deck of this color combination, I'm going to look for an excuse to put this card in my deck. I think it is more conditional than that.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit it on the nose where, like, I've liked it in the Cascade decks, but I think every application of it outside of that, I have been underwhelmed.
Are you not a fan of the M. Hayashi Mono Blue Special, then?
No, that was the pinnacle of the card is a bad, cheap answer and a mediocre, expensive threat. That was kind of... They never got any more extreme than that.
I guess we can briefly touch on Grief, because right now that one seems pigeonholed into either you're playing Living End, and then there's some debate within that over whether you want Grief. And then, you know, some of the more fringe decks where Grief did show up, like Esper Reanimator, have mostly dropped off the map. The one exception really is the Rakdos Scan deck, where Grief is a foundational part of what that deck is trying to do and is legitimately a sacred cow there. There's no real talk of cutting that one. But I don't know if there's any kind of a marginal Grief deck, if that makes sense, where its position is really up for debate. It feels like you either know that you want it or you don't.
Well, that's because it involves playing with, like, 11 other black cards, and that is the biggest commitment possible in Modern.
And even stuff like the Mono Black Coffers deck, where your entire hand is going to be full of uncastable black cards most of the time, it doesn't seem to have a home for that. Or maybe it should. Maybe that's the next step in that deck's evolution. But look, let's get into the ones that see more play and have been bigger parts of the format for longer. So Endurance, Fury, and Solitude. Fury is, I think, the one who is most contested at the moment, where I feel like one of the lines that we repeat the most often is, this deck just seems untenable in the face of Fury. And then on the other side, you have the decks that previously were all about having Isis of Fury looking for reasons to go down on that card or even cut it altogether. So, you know, in four color, it went from an automatic four of in, like, the Elementals decks way back when to, we can shave a copy and, hey, we have Eladamri's Call now, stuff like that, so we can go down to three or maybe even two. And then in the Traverse list, it was, well, we know we want the first copy for our Traverses. Of course we do, but we don't really want any more than that, to people broaching the idea of, well, maybe we don't even need the first copy. Maybe we can do away with that one altogether. So that's a card whose stock really has risen and fallen over the past few months, and I'm still not quite sure where I land on it.
Yeah, I think that it is overrated as a card you pitch to cast, but underrated as just, like, the best Shriek Maw, or the best hard cast Shriek Maw of all time. I guess the best Necrotal. Like, when you cast Fury and kill something with it, it is an urgent threat for your opponent to answer, and there's a lot of stuff that the 5-mana Fury kills. I think the problem is just, like, the things that the 0-mana Fury kills are, like, so sketchy, And it has a lot of the same problem as Subtlety, where it's like, I don't really want to throw away two cards to kill, like, one dinky one drop a lot of the times, and, like, it doesn't trade up. So, like, I'm going to, you know, I think Solitude, let's tie that one in, is, like, pretty appropriately rated as, like, awesome. And that's because it trades up. Like, you are getting into a lot of scenarios where, like, your opponent is making a play, like, a threat that is investing a lot of resources, like a Murktide Regent, or they're, like, committing to it in some additional way, like Colossus Hammer. So when you go down a card to cast Solitude, you're actually getting a lot of that back in terms of just, like, time and, like, situationality and things like that. Fury, because it's not really getting these, like, crazy sweeper moments, is not really having that. It's just kind of like, I don't know, sorcery speed, kill a Ragavan. Like, what are you doing?
This was part of our discussions with Rhinos, where I kept trying to convince people to play more lands, and part of that was Fury had... It was still a card you wanted, if only because with the dead body constraints you were working under, it wasn't quite clear what you would put in its place, but you were less keen to draw it, and you were less keen to just fire it off in the first few turns to just wipe their entire board, just because that opportunity did not really present itself much anymore. But it was still a card that you were excited to draw on, like, turn 4 or turn 5, where if you could hardcast that thing, that was your mid game, like, that you were very happy to do that. And so just making sure you hit that fifth land drop and not just that third land drop actually became a real priority now. So seeing that card's kind of modality, like, one half of it was more important and one half of it was less important at the same time, was like a weird thing to witness.
Yeah, that's basically the same spot I'm at. So I'm not shocked, but it is also very, like, incongruent with, like, what you expect the cycle to be providing.
Yeah, it is the same way in the Glimpse deck I found, where it does enough. Like, you're happy to hit it off your Glimpse, and that, I guess, counts as hardcasting it in a weird way. And you want it with Risen Reef, and you have the trick where you respond to the Evoke trigger with a Violent Outburst, and then that's plus one to your permanent count. So it kind of does a little bit of everything there. But it's the same spot of, you're not really firing it off early to sweep their board. You're more like, you're more able to wait to set up a line where you Risen Reef and then cast Fury, because there's less impetus on you to cast it early, because those decks where you would need to do that just don't really exist in the same way. It's like this weird dynamic going on there.
Yeah, it is. I think that it's probably peaking this dynamic at the fact that, like, the thing I want to Fury the most is an Omnath, and, like, that really speaks volumes about where the card sits right now.
Mm-hmm. What about Endurance and Solitude then? I guess let's touch on Solitude now, because I think that one, like, that is one of the automatic fours in the four color decks. Like, a lot of the other cards, you see their numbers wax and wane. It's always for Solitude. That one is not up for debate. But the actual effectiveness of that card, it's still very good at doing what it does. And I think the first Solitude is always this threat that's looming over the game. So if you're a deck like Amulet Titan or Hammer, and you're faced with this decision of, do I commit or overcommit into a potential Solitude, that is always a really tricky dilemma. But what I've been finding increasingly is these decks are setting themselves up to, you know, you get Solituded once, and maybe you get a good 2-for-1 in that exchange, and then you can kind of press that forward, and then if they have the second Solitude, then maybe that's another 2-for-1, and then suddenly they're kind of running out of cards. Or if they don't have the second Solitude, they need some other specific removal spell potentially in their 80 card deck to remain in the game. And so I think it's easier to set up these spots now where you just put them to the test and make them have it repeatedly, and Solitude is doing less work to be this automatic bailout in those scenarios.
Yeah, I think the thing that you're kind of, like, skipping over there is that there is a very precise window where you can push that between where they have to pitch for the Solitude and then they just get to tap mana, because as soon as they tap mana for the Solitude, then everything flips around and they've regenerated that card advantage. So I think that that is why I kind of, like, think Solitude is, I can't say underrated, but, like, not, certainly not overrated, because that pressure that it applies to every game is something that is sort of unspoken and, like, really dictates all the matches that it's involved in.
Yeah, I think the fact that Solitude basically always is at least good and often devastating, it makes it easy to hand wave away certain questions as, oh, well, I have Solitude in my deck, so I'm immune from that. Whereas you have to look at how Solitude actually lines up in practice against the cards in question. So this was when the Grixis Shadow deck was coming back on the scene late last year, well, one of the responses that was used to kind of write the deck off was, oh, well, how do you think Death Shadow lines up against Solitude? And the level zero answer is, oh, well, that's terrible. Why would you do this yourself? Why would you sign up for this? But then in practice, what you realize is you often don't have to expose two shadows at once. If they're having to Solitude one shadow, then that's still mostly a fine exchange for you. And you're a deck that has like Thoughtseize, Drowning the Log. You can set up these turns where they kind of have to Solitude and it's a risky proposition for them. And I think by the end of Lurrus's time in Modern, it was generally agreed that the Lurrus versus Yurion matchup had swung in favor of Lurrus there. And so I think that Solitude is still excellent. It's still a reason to play a white deck or a big draw to any of the four color archetypes. But I don't think that you can just uncritically be like, oh, well, I have Solitude, so I'm good to go. Nothing can possibly touch me. You really have to often be judicious about how and when you use that card.
Yeah, that is totally accurate. And again, one of the reasons that Izzet is so, you know, you said Shadow, but also Izzet is so great is because they just force their opponent to use Solitude in bad spots all the time.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish out that tour then with Endurance, which in the early days of MH2, this was, this is probably a good cyborg card, and I can imagine putting this in a lot of my green decks. And over time, it's worked its way to this card, which you look for excuses to put it in your main deck, and then the reaction to that, where now those decks which previously had this glaring weakness to Endurance, a lot of them are finding ways to mitigate that or to bob and weave around that. And I think its power is more contextual than it seemed at first, where, so against like Izzet and Shadow now, just the mere fact that Ledger Shredder exists has really changed how hard you can afford to lean on that card there.
Yeah, Endurance is extremely overrated. And I also mentioned the issue with Living End and Leyline of Sanctity, where like that is just something that you should be trying to think about and plan around. And Endurance is just the exact way that problem occurs over and over. It's like, oh, well, I just can't target them, can't deal anything with their graveyard. Guess the game's over. The only spot I think Endurance is not overrated right now is in the Living End Mirror, and like, I'll let other people think about that.
Yes, I guess that could be a topic for an episode in its own right, but only if all other options have exhausted themselves.
Yeah. We'll talk about Explorer before we talk about that. Well, let's just say that right now.
Yes. Moving swiftly on then, what do we want to talk about next?
Let's talk about like the other hot new card in Traverse the Ulvenwald.
Yeah, so this was the hot old card back in 2016, where there were a lot of very fun but also dodgy looking Traverse the Ulvenwald decks in Modern floating around, and none of them really had much staying power. And it's a card which I think has a lot of potential, and it's maybe a good design in the sense of it looks more dangerous than it actually is, because there's a lot of obvious counterplay there. Like, you know what you need to do to nullify that card, and you have to jump through enough hoops to enable it that it's not really enabling any kind of super funky combo deck where you're fetching this namesake creature on turn three or whatever, and that lets you go off to the races. So when the Traverse variant of four color was popping up, I assumed that the draw to that mainly was Unholy Heat and to a lesser extent Mistress Ball, actually, and that over time those aspects of the deck would kind of decouple themselves, and so the next iteration would be four color that had Mistress Bauble, Unholy Heat, that maybe went back to Eladami School, or maybe found other uses for those slots, and that Traverse was the most shaky part of that package. That doesn't seem to have happened, at least so far. It feels like all of those decks are running those three cards in tandem, and even though the rest of that shell has fluctuated or opened up, so we saw like Jerry put that package into the Elementals deck and really run with that, you do still see like Traverse plus Bauble plus Unholy Heat, and if there is a card in there that gets dropped, sometimes it's Mistress Bauble instead of Traverse. So it feels like the consensus has moved towards Traverse itself being an incentive to do this and not just an afterthought instead.
Yeah, I think that Traverse is like overrated in the sense that it's not going to drastically change your... I don't want to say like drastically change it. I think that the role it's trying to play, aside from like all the stuff we covered last week where like it costs one and it does all this little stuff, is that like, it's hard for Traverse to be like that impactful or that blank at any point. Whereas every other card you would fill out the last, like, 77th through 80th slot in your deck with has a lot of bad card potential. And, like, when you are just, like, I'm a deck that's full of raw 2-for-1s and, like, I just gotta live and cast my cards, you're just trying to mitigate the spots where you draw, like, 3 bad cards in a matchup on accident, and then, like, even if you can cast them, you don't have a good hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what matchup specifically Traverse improves over the other stuff you could be doing with those slots. I think it's more a case of just making your deck more fundamentally solid, and then the rest kind of writes itself, but it's hard to trace back the decisions being made there and pinpoint, oh, Traverse is what really rescued me in a spot where the other builds wouldn't have been up to snuff.
Yeah, that, like I said, its goal, it feels like it's just to be as inoffensive as possible relative to every other option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I almost wish that Traverse were more dangerous and that there was more kind of a risk attached to it, because I would want to go deeper into this card and build more decks around it, but I think it has settled into the realistic limits of its potential here.
Yeah, realistic limits is accurate. Let's talk about something on the flip side of where we're seeing Traverse, and that's Blood Moon. I want to just come out front and say I think Blood Moon is, like, drastically underrated right now.
Okay.
I think that Blood Moon has been, like, overplaying is it the last couple weeks. I have wanted to sideboard in Blood Moon against Yawgmoth, Grixis, Hammer, Four Color, Amulet, Tron. It's just like this, it's just like this astronomical spread of decks where it's just like, oh yeah, like, I'll just put a Blood Moon or two in my deck, whatever. They'll probably just lose the game to it if that happens. And I think that because there is not a deck that is, like, I don't know. I mean, how functional do you think the M. Hayashi Obosh deck is? But because there isn't, like, a deck that's just, like, a normal modern deck that has main deck Blood Moon, a lot of decks have drifted away from building in a way that they are functional under a Blood Moon. And I think that there's just a lot of room for, like, a otherwise good deck that just has access to Magus of the Moon or Blood Moon to just kind of show up and wreck people in spots where, like, I don't know. It just feels like every single time I could board it in as Issit, like, it's just going to be great. Like, there's just a lot of spots where, like, they have to beat every single other Issit card in my deck and then also might just die to Blood Moon.
Yeah, it feels like one of the few constants over more than a decade of modern at this point has been those, like, mono red decks or gruel decks, which every other card in the deck combined is, like, not up to snuff, but Blood Moon, just having access to 4 to 8 Blood Moon effects is enough to seal enough games or enough matchups by itself that those decks actually look somewhat plausible some amount of the time. And yeah, I think that even decks which are leaning less hard on Blood Moon because they actually do have other things going for them can still use Blood Moon to really good effect. And I think that in the context of Murktide in particular, Blood Moon is, I think, still underrated at this point. Let's touch on that comparison between Blood Moon and Magus of the Moon, because we saw people get very clever when the primary target for Blood Moon were these linear decks that didn't have much creature removal, and if anything, were better at answering an enchantment than they were at answering a creature. So decks like some builds of Hammer or Amna Titan is the big example that comes to mind here, Tron, and the list goes on and on. And especially in a world of, like, Besaidu who endures and so on, these decks, in some cases, had searchable answers to a Blood Moon, but were kind of out of luck if you presented them with a Magus of the Moon early on. And so even the four-color decks could dabble in this angle now, because these Eladamris calls, which they kind of wanted to play anyway, could just give them this whole new angle of attack, which is, it's still absurd to think that that was a thing you could do in your four-color deck and expect the opponent to get screwed more than you, but that's the world that we live in nowadays.
Whoa. We just covered it in a five-color Urza Saga deck, so yeah, four colors is well within reason.
I mean, I'm not sure that you are screwing the opponent more than yourself in that context. I would have to see that to believe it, but I think in the decks that have that choice, we may have cycled back around to Blood Moon being a better angle because there are now a lot more foes in the format where those effects are good again. So against Yawgmoth, for instance, they can actually answer a Magus of the Moon more easily, or like the creativity decks, for example, right? Your Makers is going to get lightning bolted or something in a way that your actual Blood Moon is not going to. And so if you're still looking at a narrow use for that card, then maybe there's a case for Makers still. But I think one of the reasons that the card Blood Moon is better than it has been in quite a while is there are more decks where the card Blood Moon compared to Makers of the Moon is more effective now.
Yeah, you also mentioned this alongside with like Traverse is like, oh, there's a lot more Unholy Heats in the four color decks. And I said, oh, I want to Blood Moon the Grixis like Shadow. Like their deck can cast approximately two spells after a Blood Moon resolves. Well, one of those is Unholy Heat. So it really has to be exactly Blood Moon and not Magus in probably about 30% of the matchups you want it in, maybe 40 if you account for like popularity.
Yeah, so I think the verdict on Blood Moon is better than it has been in a while and worth having in your sideboard, especially in Is It, and worth having as a centerpiece of your plan in various matchups, but it probably has to be exactly Blood Moon in most of those matchups. And this one-to-one split or this move towards Makers that we've seen in the past, there have been times where that has been a genius maneuver. I remember some of the Canadians actually, back when, you know, Modern was essentially Splinter Twin versus Summer Bloom, switched out their Blood Moons for Maguses, because at that point the Amulet decks all had like four Seal of Primordium in their sideboard, which were coming in for you anyway, and this let you bob and weave around the most common like anti-hate card or the most common counterplay to your hate. So I would keep an eye out for opportunities to do that, and there will be spots where going to Magus is correct again, but for now I would be all about Blood Moon, and I would be all about specifically Blood Moon.
Yeah, let's talk about another longtime card in Thoughtseize. I joked about how Grief's problem is that it involves you putting another 11 black cards in your deck. Thoughtseize might not have exactly that problem, but do you think it's doing okay these days?
I think the issue is that Grixis Shadow took over the mantle of this is the premier Thoughtseize deck, and back in the Lurrus days, that was the best place to be. Like, Grixis Shadow was the best deck in Modern, and so it was the best Thoughtseize deck by default as well. Nowadays, I think a lot of that metagame share has gone back towards Is It Murktide. Like, when, if you're someone who enjoys casting Expressive Iteration and Ragavan, and Is It Murktide is already 25% of the room at any given time, like, there's only so many Ragavans and iterations left over for those enjoyers to put in their Shadow decks instead. And so with Shadow on the decline and none of the other Thoughtseize decks really rising up in its place, then it's unclear what deck you're even meant to put this card in.
Yeah, I agree with that I don't really know where you're playing Thoughtseize, but I think the card is slightly underrated in terms of like its impact, because it had such a dry spell that like, even after the Lurrus ban, it wasn't really doing the thing it needed. But one of the things I've kind of come around to with like these main deck Thoughtseizes out of Yawgmoth is that there's like a lot of the problem with decks playing against specifically like four color is that there's a million different ways they can lose to four color and they can't play around them all at once. So the combination of like stripping away one of their angles because they lack a lot of redundancy, really powerful, and knowing what other things you have to play around, also really powerful. So I think that the card is slightly underrated as a tool to beat four color these days, but that might be about it.
Maybe the home is Ragdos Scan. Maybe that's a Thoughtseize deck we should all be moving towards.
Yeah, and you know that also is Grief, which is applying a lot of the same principles. Like that card, I think I underrated it a bit a couple of weeks ago, but like it has the same problem where like, how can you underrate a card if there's no deck to put it in? So I don't know, if there's like a third and fourth playable black card to put with Grief and Thoughtseize, I'm listening.
That one is also a Grief and Fury deck and a Blood Moon deck, and I guess a Ragavan deck too. It kind of crosses off every box on this list.
Yeah, that's not that bad. Those are a lot of cards that we said are good, along with cards that we said are good but underplayed. It's just like, I don't know, your other cards are Feign Death or whatever. So, you know, your mileage may vary.
Yeah, let's go on to a card which I think has seen a resurgence as this very generic sideboard card for a very specific purpose, and that's Chalice of the Void.
I think Chalice is massively overrated. It is probably the biggest offender of the issue I have of a lot of the choices people are making against Living End and Footfalls, which is you can't play a second Chalice. And they're really good at beating exactly one hate permanent. you Chalice for zero, and then your next Chalice for zero gets countered. So what are you going to do? The answer is just play a mix of cards that aren't Chalice instead. I think that, like, maybe the first Chalice is okay, but if you're ever thinking about playing a second Chalice, just play a different card instead. So you could draw them both and play them both at the same time. And I actually think Jarvis Yu may have taken... I don't know if he took the reverse of this or, like, went the other way, but I know that when he won his RCQ with four-color Traverse, there was a spot where he split Chalice and Lavinia and drew them both exactly to KO Living End. So I think that's the play you should be angling for. Like, all my Hammer lists, they have, like, two Lavinias, but then also a Drowneth Magistrate. And, like, one of the Hammer lists from the Challenge Top 8 this weekend just had three Lavinias, and they're just going to draw two Lavinias in a game, and it's just going to be bad. So don't do that to yourself. And if you are playing, like I said, if you're playing more than one Chalice, don't do that.
I think the underrated home for Chalice is in decks which can already fight the Cascade decks in other ways, perhaps on the stack, but want to diversify their portfolio, if that makes sense, with some more permanent-based hate. So I think Chalice in the sideboard of Is It Murktide, for example, is if you really want to hit those Cascade matchups hard and do it all at once, then yeah, you can play even more Flusterstorms, or you can play even more of the maybe the soft permission that we'll come onto later in this list. But I think that if you have those slots to spare, then mixing that up with, you know, one to two Chalice and some Flusterstorms, like, that really gives you this bulletproof plan where against Is It in particular, a lot of the anti Chalice measures don't really have any other clear uses, and so it's really hard for them to hedge in a useful way against that.
That's totally fair. I guess I'll also note that, like, we're talking about Chalice out of Is It. I have been increasingly underwhelmed with Chalice against Is It and Hammer, as, like, I think Chalice on one is at, I don't want to say an all-time low, but, like, the disparity between how good you expect it to be against this metagame and how good it actually is really large right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just, too many Ledger Shredders, too many Stoneforge Mystics, Finding Cauldra.
Yeah. What other card do we want to touch on next?
Let's go down through a few other cards that counter spells between Spell Pierce, Spell Snare, and Counterspell. Let's start with Spell Pierce.
Yeah, so I think this card is maybe a little underrated in the homes where you would expect to see it. So namely, you know, Murktide, Shadow, that kind of deck, and still very effective there. But I think its real home and where it serves this unique role is in decks like the Creativity deck, where you see main deck Spell Pierces a lot of the time, and I think that goes a long way in addressing the inherent clunkiness of decks like that, where if you're trying to build towards this 4-plus mana sorcery speed payoff, then it's really nice to have this one-mana interaction that can either help to force that through on the critical turn, or to help progress the game to the point where you can try and have that fight in the first place.
Yeah, I think that it is definitely underrated in that shell. I have found it kind of overrated across the board and everything else. Like, out of Hammer, I have found it underwhelming at protecting against a lot of things. Out of Is It, I have found it underwhelming because it's like, I don't know, you play Mirrors and it's just like, oh, I'm trying to fight over all the creatures and, like, Spell Pierce doesn't do that. I don't know. I've just found it lacking in a lot of spots, with the, like, lone exception of Creativity, where it's just, like, you don't, like, if you get to trade Spell Pierce for anything to just make the game not end before you resolve Creativity, that's great. Like, there's not a lot of thought about what you're lining it up with. The more you have to think about what you're lining Spell Pierce up with, the more likely it is that just, like, it doesn't do that, because it has to target a one-mana spell or, you know, all sorts of stuff that doesn't line up.
Yeah, I know that you're a big fan of Spell Snare at the moment. How much is that tied to having a specific two-drop in mind to target? So against a deck like Yawgmoth, for example, are you bringing that in, and do you have visions of, you know, rubbing your hands together and tagging their Strangler guys on turn two? Or is it where you're against a deck like Hammer, where, like, you know that Pure Steel Paladin and Stoneforge Mystic are, like, essential cards to how the deck operates, and that's what you have in mind there?
I don't actually... So Yawgmoth is a matchup where I don't like it. It's, like, very specifically a matchup where... Or the point of the card is that there has to be at least one card that I feel like I have to counter with Spell Snare, and then one or two more cards where if I just get to chuck a Spell Snare at them, it's good. So, like, in the is it mirror, that comes down to hitting iteration or ledger shredder, absolutely. But if I get the spell snare or counterspell, that's great. Hammer, it's like I gotta counter pure steel. But if I hit a Stoneforge Mystic, also really good. I mean, guess you probably just counter whatever. Like, that's totally fine. Burn, like, it. You have to kill Eidolon, but, like, hitting a Boros Charm, fine. You have to counter Ren and Six, but, like, they're going to probably play an iteration at some point over the game if you, you know, don't have a Ren and Six. I guess it's not, like, every four-color list that has it, but, like, yeah, that's... I think that's it. And then also part of the Spell Snare thing is, like, I think Spell Snare is supposed to be paired with Ledger Shredder because you can just get rid of it whenever you want to. And obviously there's like a limit on like how many pierces and snares together you can run because they both share that attribute a little bit. But like you get the free roll cards like this a little bit more because of Shredder.
And are you keen on having it in the mirrors given how important cards like Ledger Shredder and Expressive Iteration are?
Yeah, I think that this is the card that like Spell Pierce in the Mirror is never going to counter a creature and is, like, often going to line up awkwardly against a removal spell. Snare is just, like, always gonna, like, it can hit Shredder, it will hit, like, Shredder and Iteration are two of the more important cards in the Mirror. They're not Murktide, but you can't Spell Pierce a Murktide, so whatever. And you can't Spell Pierce a Rogmon, so whatever. But, like, if you listed probably a third and fourth most important card, those are them. And then, like, anytime it hits a counterspell, that's basically, like, backing up whatever the most important thing you were playing that they were aiming a counterspell at was.
I guess, and License Hearse as well, given that that's such a big part of these heroes too.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that card, yeah, that was the capstone to my RCQ, was my opponent. I played Hearse on two, and my opponent went, consider, keep on top, flip Spell Fierce onto the table, and then played their Hearse, and then I died.
So, yeah, this one was not on the list, but I'm guessing the verdict, the snap verdict is Unlicensed Hearse, just as good as advertised?
Yes, I think so. I was pretty down on this card for a couple weeks, but I've come back around to it for a couple sideways uses. I think that during the weeks where it was a little more muddled, where whether you want to play Shadow or Is It, the card was less exciting. But I think that between the like Ley Lines out of Living End thing that Hearse dodges, that's like a big plus for it. And then also the Return of Yawgmoth, and Hearse just being a pretty functional card there. I think that Hearse is coming around to being, like, a little bit underrated, and, like, people have been trimming it for, like, zero mana effects to beat Living End, just like, oh, I'm just gonna slam a Tormod's Crypt on turn zero and have it locked up. I think that across the board, you should probably consider Unlicensed Hearse. Not quite where it was at its peak, but it's ramping back up that way.
We mentioned some conditional counterspells. How about the card counterspell?
I think that Counterspell is reaching the point of being overrated, and I think that there are a lot of decks that are trying to be Is It that are basically working on the axis of exploiting the fact that Counterspell is one of their best cards. If you just, like, I mean, this is just the hammer principle, where it's like, I'm going to cast multiple spells that cost one, or, like, really force the game down a specific direction, where, like, you have to leave two mana up and then pay two mana to resolve Counterspell. And that's not remotely assured. I've been sideboarding out Counterspell more now than I think I would ever have expected.
That's really interesting. What would have to change, do you think, to make Counterspell a card that you're more excited about? Would it just be the format slowing down, or is there something more to it?
I don't think you can have that world in a metagame that is 25% Is It, because any deck that, like, starts making Counterspell good again is immediately punted out of the metagame because it's just not going to be Is It.
Huh. How good is it in the Is It mirrors, in your experience?
This is a tricky spot. So, I think you have to trim a little on It and, or Archmage Charm. Because, like, they are cards that are out of position, like, drawing multiples. Like, you will just lose games where you have all of those and they have a Ragavan. But, like, you can't trim... I don't know. I think I ended up cutting, like, exactly one Charm or Counterspell in my plans. Because you want to avoid multiples, but you also need to hit their Murktide Regent really bad. Because, like, I don't know. There's just, you know, there isn't a card that beats a resolved Murktide Regent in the mirror. And that just happens, and the game ends. Like, I think it is... it's not in any of the cards I would name as important, but like, it is the kind of card that will not win a game, but will save you a loss, is the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like some of the same factors that make Counterspell such an effective card in the Izzet decks also make it a little unreliable in the mirrors, where when all the cards are so cheap, it can be tough to find a spot where, like, setting up whatever you want to be doing, plus 2 mana for Counterspell, like, that feels like a kind of face-up line that you're playing towards, and also one that's relatively easy to kind of bob and weave around.
Yeah, it's a lot of the same approach as Spellsnare, where, like, it is there for a very specific purpose of, like, when my opponent plays a turn 2 Ledger Shredder, I need to Spellsnare it. When my opponent plays a Murktide Regent, I need to Counterspell it. But, like, I'm not going to pass up Counterspelling an Expressive Iteration on a turn that I leave it up because, you're not sure it's ever going to get better.
It seems like, too, in a world where you can expect in the mirrors to be facing some amount of all of these various conditional Counterspells, whether it's Spell Pierce, Spell Snare, Mystical Dispute. I don't know if people are boarding in their Flusterstorms in the mirrors or whatever, but I'm sure some fraction of Murktide players are. Like, whatever mix of that you can expect, all of those cards line up very well against the card Counterspell, which is kind of like bigger and better than all of them in one sense.
Yeah, I will say that if you are boarding in your Flusterstorms in the Izzet mirror, don't do that. That's the fastest way to lose, because that situation I described with like Counterspell, like, imagine just drawing a Flusterstorm against a Ragavan hand. Like, you're just gonna lose. You can't do that. Like, you can't even Flusterstorm a Murktide Regent. Like, every card in your deck revolves around beating, like, those two cards or, like, maybe a Ledger Shredder. Those are, like, the three most important cards in the mirror, and you just can't play cards that don't interact with them on some level.
Let's go to a card which I don't know if it's underrated, but it's certainly seen an uptick in play recently, and I think that's entirely justified, and that's Engineered Explosives, which we noted a week or two ago when we saw a full three copies of this card in the sideboard of one of the Murktide decks, and that made a lot of sense to me as a catch-all against Hammer, which is a pretty tough matchup for Murktide. You'll take the help there. Good against Rhinos, which was kind of ebbing and flowing out of the format. And then in a world where the hot new thing is it creativity, or not is it creativity, four color plus creativity, this is actually one of the better sideboard cards you can bring for that matchup as well.
Yeah, I think that it was a bit underrated. Like, the first copy or two is at least underrated. And I think that the creativity matchup really showcases this, where, like, there's just, like, a lot of weird spots where this cleans up a lot of good stuff. Like, any of the other Urza Saga decks or, like, Footfalls, like, just, you know, even against Shadow, like, I'll probably bring in one. Just don't bring in more than one or two against anything but Hammer or maybe one or two other decks, and you should be good. But, like, it has just randomly picked up a lot of other stuff, and a lot of the spots where it was like, oh, well, Engineered Explosives is in your sideboard, but you shouldn't board it in, those kind of don't really exist right now, because I think, A, people have learned them, and B, a lot of them had to do with lures.
We also grouped this along with Dressdown on the list, which is a very different card and a very unique card that has its own niche in the format. Where do you think that one stands right now?
I don't really like Dressdown right now. I think that the application against Urza Saga is obviously still great, but I think a lot of the other applications of Dressdown are kind of not there. Like, aside from the literal card Primeval Titan, I think a lot of stuff has to line up. Like, it is always Dressdown and something else. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to Dressdown against Yawgmoth. That means I need also the Unholy Heat or, like, I don't know, to be in combat with two undying creatures.
Yeah, it was notable to me that the early list of Four Color Traverse went really hard on Dressdown, having as many as three copies main deck at some points, and they have progressively moved away from that card to the point where it's now hit or miss whether you see that card in the main deck at all, let alone in the wider 95.
Yeah, it's really just the cleanest way to kill Urza Saga tokens, and like, yeah, I don't know, I want to bring up the Archon thing where it's like, yeah, I dressed down their Archon. It's like, okay, I also need to Unholy Heat their Archon. Like, It's that and. Unless it's Urza Saga, in which case it's going to clean it up real well. And I think that revising my, like, is it sideboard, I might be ticking down to one of this card with the, I don't know, I really just wish, like, if I could play a card that was functional in the mirror against the non-Hearse games, could kill a Hearse, and then also was, like, anti-artifact, so good against Hammer Time, That would be the exact card I want to play instead of the additional dress down.
Yeah, I think it's also a card which can be very difficult to play around, but if they know, if they had the knowledge, like if it's an open decklist tournament or whatever, that you only have, let's say, one copy in your deck, then it's often not going to make sense or not be feasible for them to play around it. So they just have to play into it. And at that point, not having it kind of leaves you exposed to whatever's going on. So it's this weird thing where you want your range to have a lot of dress downs in it more than you actually want the card dress down some of the time.
Yeah, the only other thing I like about it is the card type.
Yes, and that's where maybe that was more of the draw initially in the Traversalist, where just having an enchantment that replaced itself and bin itself, that was the draw, that was the hook, and then the actual turning off creature types or turning off abilities in this weird way for a turn was almost the cherry on top of that.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it doesn't cover as much as I think you would want it to these days, but like it's low-ish cost, but I think the cost is rising back up because it's no longer like trying to line up with Risen Reese. It's always lining up against like efficient Urza Sagas.
Okay, let's get through the final items on this list then. And one of these is Supreme Verdict, which was a card which you expect to see in a deck like Azorius Control. And we have seen at various points in four color as well, just in the main deck, in the sideboard, usually in small numbers. I've seen it a lot more recently, but I don't know if there's a solid reason for that other than whatever solid reasons led the established four color players to put it in the list, which now everyone else is cribbing from.
Yeah, I think that this is like the good version of the and whatever, because Supreme Verdict is always the thing that like your opponent makes plays to beat something else, and then it's like, oh yeah, I had Supreme Verdict, and then that's a wrap. So like your opponent is like grinding you out with hammer and not comboing, and then just like get Supreme Verdict in. They're like, oh, that's a lot of resources. Or like Living End player is like, okay, I have lined up all my stuff to beat the hate cards, and then, oh, I got Supreme Verdicted. That's not great. Like, is it, again, like, it is a card that cleanly kills a Murktide. I think it's a little bit underrated right now in terms of, like, it has the similar effect to Blood Moon, where it's like, yeah, I'm not, like, jamming Supreme Verdict. It's not the best thing versus everything, but, like, if I have one or two, it wins me a lot of games against a lot of decks where it previously was like a liability, but I think that's about the extent of it. So like a little bit underrated. I even think that like the second copy in the Daryl version of four color might be pushing it.
I know Jarvis was a big booster for this card, and I was trying to tease out from him how much of the value here is tied up in the Wrath of God effect versus the can't be countered line. So you can imagine against like Living End, for example, where they Shardless Agent into Living End, and maybe they don't have the grief to take your Supreme Verdict, and then this is the one thing which can clean up their board even through Force Negation or against Hammer, right? They're going wide and going tall at the same time, and Verdict answers all of that in a way that few other cards could. But more broadly, against a deck like Izzet or Grixis Shadow, it wasn't clear to me if like how often Supreme Verdict was just an even more expensive Void Rend, if that makes sense. Like you're cleaning up the one thing that they have left on the board, but maybe not getting Drowned in the Locked or not getting counterspelled is enough to justify the pretty hefty sticker price on that card.
I think it's like 70-30 in favor of the sweeper, and even in those matchups it's like 50-50. Like there's a problem where like the answer outside of Supreme Verdict to all the four color answers is generally just like if you produce multiple threats and are like your opponent just has to answer them all, and like it can often get clunky in some time frame and you win. Like if you also control a Ledger Shredder when you play a Murktide Regent, the four color player is going to struggle unless they have like this exact specific setup and you can't break up Ephemerate. Supreme Verdict beats both that and also like Murktide plus Counterspell. So I think both sides of it are really important for fighting against exactly how the Izzet player is going to try to approach the matchup.
It does cover two different types of game, which I think are both important, where either they don't have many threats, but they're protecting the queen. And so Supreme Verdict cleans up one of the few threats or even both of them through any amount of protection, really. And then the games where they are heavy on threats, but light on interaction, and trying to deal with those one by one, you know, with Solitude or Prismatic Ending or whatever, might be a losing battle, but getting to do that all at once and fight through maybe the one piece of interaction that they have is where you want to be. So maybe those two different scenarios combined are enough to justify the card. I just have visions of, you know, spending four mana to kill one Ledger Shredder or something, and then just dash Ragavan doing me enough that.
Yeah, I think that's a spot where you're just supposed to not cast it. But, like, you were talking, you know, way earlier about that gap where, like, oh, well, I have evoked a Fury and I don't or evoked a Solitude and I don't really want to form myself again. Like, Supreme Verdict is the exact card for that time frame because, like you said, either they are going around this, like, protecting their threat or they're, like, going wide. And whatever happens in the aftermath of your first answer, Supreme Verdict bridges you to the point where, like, you are suddenly in the hard cast Solitude game.
And speaking of Ragavan, let's end the segment for this episode by talking about the richest monkey in Modern.
Yeah, I mean, this was the debate on Twitter this week, right? Like, is was it a canister tweet? Was Expressive Iteration or Ragavan, which one's better in Modern? Ragavan is just massively, like, it's impossible. It is somehow underrated, despite every single deck respecting it to the absolute max. The debate I got into with my Yawgmoth opponent after, because, like, we both weren't exactly sure, was how many Young Wolves are you supposed to side out? Because if you just side out, like, Young Wolves in the Izzet matchup, like, they'll just kill you with a Ragavan. But if you don't, then you just have, like, Young Wolf against all their non-Ragavan hands. Like, what are you supposed to do about that? The card is just absurdly good versus literally everything. Doesn't even matter if, like, I cast a Colossus Hammer off of it because it triggered a Ledger Shredder. Like, who cares? Like, Ragavan just, like, oh my gosh. Like, the extra mana is underrated. Killing your opponent's underrated. Dashing the card is underrated. I don't know. That card's just stupid.
It's really a mess-up card. With the benefit, I suppose, of over a year of playtime with it at this point, what's the verdict for you on, was it a mistake conclusively, or is there more nuance to it than that for you?
I don't think it's a mistake outside. It's like the very specific confluence of events in Murktide. I don't think that any other deck I have played with it or against it, like, it's just not as big of a problem as it is there, where it's like every single mana is, like, juiced to its full potential, and, like, the treasure producing whatever color at instant speed is huge, and, like, the flexibility of dashing it, it's really once you just, like, maximize it with every single other card that you have access to is when it really takes over. Because, like, when it was like, oh, Rakdos, like, I thought that it was really nice, like, a threat from the Rakdos and Jund decks that could appropriately pressure something like Living End, that was really nice. The problem is that, like, the Izzet deck is just already good against all those decks and just gets a free 25% when they're on the play with Ragavan.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning Ragavan as a card that just embarrassed other ways to get a mana advantage, stuff like Aetherfile or like Noble Hierarch or what have you. And I almost longed for the days or for the decks where that's kind of what Ragavan was doing, where you think about some of these aspiring spike decks where Ragavan is like, let you cast turn two Mayhem Devil and then next turn the treasure token that you're getting can be sacrificed to, you know, ping with Mayhem Devil and set up these other synergies. Like, there are ways you can use Ragavan to enable cool other stuff where it's just like greasing the wheels and making stuff happen, but when you are just pairing it with all of the cards that we know are good in the Izzet shells across like four different formats, that's when, including at least one format where Ragavan itself is now banned for its crimes in that context, that's where it really kind of grates on me and becomes this repetitive experience.
Yeah, I think the only other deck that may rival that in terms of how well it used Ragavan was the Crack the Irk deck that briefly existed, where, like, not only was Ragavan, like, it was the extra material, and, like, when you outmanage your opponent with your Stone Ring deck, it was just, like, over-the-top absurd, but, like, yeah, it's the inner, I don't know, when Ragavan is doing the worst it can, it feels really bad, and that might just be a general statement about, like, how we're supposed to view cards in Modern and in, like, Magic these days, is it's never about, like, I don't know, people talk about, like, oh, I want X, Y, and Z in the Modern format, and it's just, like, what's the worst thing someone's going to do to you? And this is just, like, the Doomsday Thassa's Oracle is just, like, yeah, Ragavan plus Counterspell is just the Doomsday Thassa's Oracle of the format right now.
Yeah, I had a Canisa-esque poll a few years ago when that set dropped of which of these cards is more powerful, like Uro or Thassa's Oracle. And in some sense, it's a very bad question. Like, if I was asking it honestly, I would need to slap myself for that. But I think that the fact that you can construe a case where that is up in the air is, like, pretty nonsensical to me. But yeah, on the topic of Ragavan, like, if the worst that someone was doing is it with it was the Crack the Earth deck, I would not enjoy being on the receiving end of that, but I would at least respect them for trying and for what they had to do to make that happen.
Yeah, yeah. I, again, not too good, but, like, it is a lot. It is certainly a lot.
Yes. So let's close this out here with some nonsense of the week. And only one deck to feature this week, but hot off the heels of our four-color focus episode, I thought we'd focus on a deck which is an entirely different combination of four colors and has some cards which even none of those seven different four-color decks can feature themselves.
Excuse me? I'm sorry, I just clicked the link for the first time because you posted this in here without the link to start as a teaser, and what?
But what? And this is a perfectly unremarkable modern deck.
Yeah, this is a Karth the Lion. I think you described it as Glint-Eye Karth the Lion. What I was not expecting was Nicol Bolas Dragon God to be showing up in yet another non-rotating format.
Well, see, these days when you see Nicol Bolas Dragon God, it's not in some Grixis deck that wants to cast a card fairly. It's in your otherwise mono-green deck where the mere presence of one Nicol Bolas that you're trying to cheat into play off Storm the Festival or Oath of Nyssa is enough to have Goldfish label it as four-color ramp for the rest of time. I guess in this deck, it's a little bit of both. Like, we have Oath of Nyssa, and that's going to be doing some real heavy lifting here. So we got some Utopia Spools. But in theory, we could hardcast this otherwise if we don't draw any of our, you know, Presages or Basic Forests.
Yeah, I mean, like, you are able to Arbor Elf to untap your Ziatora's Proving Ground and get your way there. And there's actually, like, a pretty good spread of Planeswalker abilities to use. I guess you get to... Huh. So let me just think about the math on, like, Nicol Bolas using a different Planeswalker's ability with Karth the Lion on the battlefield. That's a lot of stuff to think about.
Yeah, I think the Planeswalker in this motley crew that stands out most to me is the one Lolth Spider Queen, where I have to think in the entire run of modern and of the Planeswalker card type, there have got to be better 5-drops than Lolth, but none are actually coming to mind for me. Maybe this is the best of the best.
I think it's pretty good, and, like, it breaks even on the spiders with Karth, and the spiders are actually effective answers to, like, a Murktide Regent or Ledger Shredder pressuring your Planeswalkers. It's probably a little better than you think, but also, yeah, all the other, like, 5-mana Planeswalkers are just, like, Obnixiluses. It's very possible it gets outclassed in the next, like, 3 releases, for sure.
Yeah, this deck also does have, like, the Legacy Cube vibe, almost, of just take a bunch of these cheap removal spells and 7 different Planeswalkers, and that's my deck. And it almost doesn't matter what those Planeswalkers are or what any of the loyalty abilities are. I'm just going to spam as many of those as possible on every turn cycle, and that's going to do it.
I'm kind of loving that this deck is, like, great. Yeah, it's Golgari Double Splash, so, like, The Nicol Bolas is literally just double splashing in both directions because your other red cards are 4 Renin 6 and 2 Lightning Bolts, and your other blue cards are 1 Ashiok and 4 Sideboard Spellpierce.
Yeah, 4 Sideboard Spellpierce. So this player got the memo.
Okay, yeah. All the Spellpierces, no Flusterstorms. The like list of sideboard interaction here is really interesting. Like, Weather the Storm to beat Burn, Emrakul to beat Mill, and, like, I don't know, I guess Leyline is the card versus Living End?
Yeah, we've got a Culling Ritual against decks like Hammer, where it is a shame that if you Culling Ritual away your Oath of Nyssa, you can't cast your Nicol Bolas anymore, but, you know, maybe you'll have something else to do instead.
Yeah, I think that this is a perfect application of it, because, like, you can't afford to tap 3 mana for a Wrath when all your cards cost 3 mana, but you can afford to tap 4 and then cast a 4-drop after the fact.
Yes, I do respect the exactly one copy of Force of Vigor 2, just really keeping people on their toes.
Yeah, I mean, you also don't, I guess you have a decent number of green cards, but, like, actually that's a pretty good thought, because, like, all your green cards that you pitch are things like Arbor Elf and Utopia Sprawl that you're holding onto later, and then you're very smartly making all your high-end payoffs black cards. So, like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, cool. You're going to have redundant copies of Carth Line, and that might include the first copy, but you just didn't have a good chance to cast. So, yeah, we have enough green cards to grease the wheels there. But I think that's going to do it for this week. So you can find us writing every week. I'm at SEG. He's at TCG Player. You can find us on Twitter individually. I'm at Domin Javier. He is at ARMLX. You can find the podcast, of course, on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/dominarias_judgment. And you can also find us in some other medium that is escaping me at this point.
Yeah.
Possibly the Discord.
Yeah, double check the Twitter. It has a link tree to everything. The pinned tweet should have a link to the Discord, the Spotify feed, all of the above. So, yeah. And next week, we'll be back with probably some more Pioneer-focused content as Modern kind of enters this nice little coasting through stability phase.
Yeah, I was thinking with I have SEG Baltimore coming up in just over a week. I was thinking we could maybe dip our toes into Pioneer and maybe just very briefly into Legacy as well, just giving some overviews and some recommendations of each of the formats there as Modern kind of goes through this this slow churn cycle for now.
Yeah, sounds great.
All right, so we will see you next week back for all of that. But until then, take care, everyone.